Chapter 1. General Nonsense. The general theory of relativity shows us that our minds follow different rules than the real world does. A rational mind, based on the impressions that it receives from its limited perspective, forms structures which thereafter determine what it further will and will not accept freely. From that point on, regardless of how the real world actually operates, this rational mind, following its self-imposed rules, tries to superimpose on the real world its own version of what must be. This continues until at long last a beginner's mind cries out, "This is not right. What must be is not happening. I have tried and tried to discover why this is so. I have stretched my imagination to the limit to preserve my belief in what must be. The breaking point has come. Now I have no choice but to admit that the must I have believed in does not come from the real world, but from my own head." This narrative is not poetic hyperbole. It is a concise description of the major conclusion of the general theory of relativity and the means by which it was reached. The limited perspective is the perspective of our three-dimensional rationality and its view of one small part of the universe, the part into which we were born. The things that must be are the ideas of geometry, the rules governing straight lines, circles, triangles, etc. The beginner's mind was Albert Einstein's. The long-held belief was that these rules govern, without exception, the entirety of the universe. What Einstein's beginner's mind realized was that this is so only in our minds. Einstein discovered that certain laws of geometry are valid only in limited regions of space. This makes them useful since our experience physically is limited to very small regions of space, like our solar system. However, as our experience expands, we encounter more and more difficulty in trying to superimpose these rules upon the entire expanse of the universe. Einstein was the first person to see that the geometrical rules which apply to one small part of the universe as seen from a limited perspective, like ours, are not universal. This freed him to behold the universe in a way that no person had seen it before. What he saw is the content of the general theory of relativity. Einstein did not set out to prove anything about the nature of our minds. His interest was in physics. "Our new idea," he wrote, "is simple, to build a physics valid for all coordinate systems." The fact that he did illustrate something of importance about the way that we structure our perceptions is indicative of an inevitable trend toward the merger of physics and psychology. How did Einstein get from a theory of physics to a revolutionary statement of geometry? How did that lead to a significant insight into our mental processes? The answer to these questions is one of the least known, but one of the most important and intriguing intellectual adventures recorded. Einstein started with his special theory of relativity. As successful as it was, Einstein was not satisfied with it because it applied only to coordinate systems moving uniformly relative to each other. "Is it possible," thought Einstein, "to explain the same phenomenon as seen from two different frames of reference, one of them moving uniformly and the other of them moving non-uniformly, in such a way that there is a consistent explanation for the phenomenon in terms of both the uniformly moving frame of reference and the non-uniformly moving frame of reference? In other words, can we describe events which happen in a coordinate system which is moving non-uniformly in terms which are meaningful to an observer in a coordinate system which is moving uniformly, and the other way around? Can we create one physics that is valid for observers in both frames of reference?" "Yes," discovered Einstein, "it is possible for observers in the two different frames of reference to relate in a manner which is both meaningful in terms of their own state of motion and in terms of the other's state of motion." To illustrate this, he used another famous thought experiment. Imagine an elevator in an extraordinarily tall building. The cable which supports the elevator has snapped, and the elevator is plummeting downward. Inside the elevator are several physicists. They are not aware that the cable is broken, and since there are no windows, they cannot look outside. The question is, what is the appraisal of this situation by the observers on the outside of the elevator, us, and by the observers on the inside of the elevator, the physicists? Since this is an idealized experiment, we can disregard the effects of friction and the resistance of the air. To us, the situation is apparent. The elevator is falling, and soon it will strike the earth, and all of its inhabitants will be dead. As the elevator falls, it accelerates according to Newton's law of gravity. The motion of the elevator is not uniform, but accelerated, because of the gravitational field of the earth. We can predict many things that might happen inside the elevator. For example, if someone inside the elevator dropped a handkerchief, nothing would happen. It would appear to the inside observers to float where it was released, because it would be accelerating toward the earth at the same rate as the elevator and the people inside of it. Nothing really would be floating, everything would be falling, but since everything would be falling at the same rate, there would be no change in their relative positions. To a generation of physicists born and brought up inside the elevator, however, things would appear quite differently. To them, dropped objects do not fall, they simply hang in midair. If someone gives a floating object a shove, off it goes in a straight line until it hits the side of the elevator. To the observers inside the elevator, there are no forces acting on any objects inside the elevator. In short, the observers inside the elevator would conclude that they are in an inertial coordinate system. The laws of mechanics are perfectly valid. Their experiments always produce results which agree exactly with theoretical predictions. An object at rest remains at rest. An object in motion remains in motion. Moving objects are deflected from their paths only by forces which are proportional to the amount of deflection. For every reaction, there is an equal and opposite reaction. If we give a shove to a floating chair, it goes off in one direction, and we go off in the opposite direction with an equal momentum, although with a slower speed because of our greater mass. The inside observers have a consistent explanation for the phenomena inside the elevator. They are in an inertial coordinate system, and they can prove it by the laws of mechanics. The outside observers also have a consistent explanation for the phenomena inside the elevator. The elevator is falling in a gravitational field. Its passengers are unaware of this because, without being able to see outside the elevator, there is no way for them to detect it while they are falling. Their coordinate system is in accelerated motion, even though they believe that it is not moving at all. The bridge between these two explanations is gravity. The falling elevator is a pocket edition of an inertial coordinate system. A real inertial coordinate system is not limited in space or time. The elevator edition is limited in both. It is limited in space because a moving object inside the elevator will not move in a straight line forever, but only until it reaches one of the walls of the elevator. It is limited in time because sooner or later the elevator and its passengers are going to collide with the earth, ending their existence abruptly. According to the special theory of relativity, moreover, it is significant that the elevator is limited in size because otherwise it would not appear to its inhabitants as an inertial coordinate system. For example, if the physicists inside the elevator simultaneously drop two baseballs, the baseballs float in the air exactly where they are released and remain there. This, to the outside observer, is because they are falling parallel to each other. However, if the elevator were the size of Texas and the baseballs were as far apart when they were dropped as Texas is wide, the baseballs would not fall parallel to each other. They would converge, since each of them would be drawn by gravity to the center of the earth. The observers inside the elevator would notice that the baseballs and then the other floating objects in the elevator were moving toward each other with the passage of time, as though there were a mutual attraction between them. This mutual attraction would appear as a force affecting the objects in the elevator, and the physicists inside hardly would conclude, under those circumstances, that they were in an inertial coordinate system. In short, if it is small enough, a coordinate system falling in a gravitational field is the equivalent of an inertial coordinate system. This is Einstein's principle of equivalence. It is a telling piece of mental dexterity. Anything like an inertial coordinate system that can be wiped out, Einstein's words, by the assumption of a gravitational field hardly deserves to be called absolute, as in absolute motion and absolute non-motion. While the observers inside the elevator experience a lack of motion and the absence of gravity, the observers outside the elevator see a coordinate system, the elevator, accelerating through a gravitational field. Now, let us imagine a variation of this situation. Assume that we, the outside observers, are in an inertial coordinate system. We already know what happens in inertial coordinate systems, the same things that happen in the falling elevator. There are no forces, including gravity, to affect us. Therefore, let us assume that we are comfortably floating. Objects at rest remain at rest, objects in motion continue in a straight line forever, and every action produces an equal and opposite reaction. In our inertial coordinate system is an elevator. Someone has attached a rope to the elevator and is pulling it across our vision, diagonally and upward, from lower left to upper right. Since this is a thought experiment, it does not matter how this is done. The elevator is being pulled with a constant force, which means that it is in a state of constant acceleration. How will observers outside the elevator and observers inside the elevator appraise this situation? As we float outside the elevator, we experience that our frame of reference is absolutely at rest and that there is no gravity affecting it. We see the elevator being pulled with a constant acceleration by the rope, and so we can predict certain things about it. Everything inside the elevator that is not attached quickly collides with the floor of the elevator. If someone in the elevator drops a handkerchief, the elevator floor rushes up to meet it. If someone in the elevator tries to jump off the floor, rushing upward, is instantly under his feet again. The floor of the elevator continually crashes into anything in its path as it accelerates upward. Inside the elevator, however, the appraisal of the situation is quite different. To a generation of physicists born and brought up inside the elevator, talk of acceleration upward is fantasy. Remember, the elevator has no windows. To them, their coordinate system is quite at rest. Objects fall downward to the floor because of a gravitational field, just as objects on the Earth fall downward to the floor because of a gravitational field. Both the observers inside the elevator and the observers outside the elevator have consistent explanations for the phenomena inside the elevator. We observers outside the elevator explain them by the accelerated motion of the elevator. The observers inside the elevator explain them by the presence of a gravitational field. There is absolutely no way to determine which of us is right. Wait a minute, we say. Suppose that we cut a small hole in one wall of the elevator and shine a light beam through it. If the elevator really were motionless, the light beam would strike the opposite wall of the elevator at a spot exactly opposite the hole. Since we can see that the elevator is accelerating upward, we know that the elevator wall will move upward slightly in the time it takes the light beam to cross the elevator. Therefore, the light beam will strike the far wall slightly below the spot just opposite the hole it entered through. In effect, it will seem to curve downward from the point of view of the people inside the elevator instead of traveling in a straight line. This should prove to them that their elevator is in motion. It does not prove anything of the sort, says Jim DeWitt, who, of course, is inside the elevator. The light beams in this elevator do not travel in straight lines. How could they? We are in a gravitational field. Light is energy, and energy has mass. Gravity attracts mass, and a light beam traveling through our elevator will be drawn downward by our gravitational field, exactly like a baseball thrown horizontally at the speed of light. There is no way that we can convince DeWitt that his coordinate system is in a state of accelerated motion. Everything that we can say to prove this to him, he dismisses, accounts for, as a result of his gravitational field. There is absolutely no way of distinguishing between uniform accelerated motion and a constant gravitational field. This is another expression of Einstein's principle of equivalence. In limited areas, gravity is equivalent to acceleration. We already saw that acceleration, falling through a gravitational field, is the equivalent of an inertial coordinate system. Now we see that a gravitational field is equivalent to accelerated motion. At last, we are approaching a general theory of relativity, a theory valid for all frames of reference regardless of their states of motion. The bridge which links the explanations of the observers inside of the elevator and the explanations of the observers outside of the elevator is gravity. The clue which indicated to Einstein that gravity was the key to his general theory was as old as physics itself. There are two kinds of mass, which means that there are two ways of talking about it. The first is gravitational mass. The gravitational mass of an object, roughly speaking, is the weight of the object as measured on a balance scale. Something that weighs three times more than another object has three times more mass. Gravitational mass is the measure of how much force the gravity of the Earth exerts on an object. Newton's laws describe the effects of this force, which vary with the distance of the mass from the Earth. Although Newton's laws describe the effects of this force, they do not define it. This is the mystery of action at a distance. How does the Earth invisibly reach up and pull objects downward? The second type of mass is inertial mass. Inertial mass is the measure of the resistance of an object to acceleration, or deceleration, which is negative acceleration. For example, it takes three times more force to move three railroad cars from a standstill to 20 miles per hour, positive acceleration, than it takes to move one railroad car from a standstill to 20 miles per hour. Similarly, once they are moving, it takes three times more force to stop three cars than it takes to stop the single car. This is because the inertial mass of the three railroad cars is three times more than the inertial mass of the single railroad car. Inertial mass and gravitational mass are equal. This explains why a feather and a cannonball fall with equal velocity in a vacuum. The cannonball has hundreds of times more gravitational mass than the feather. It weighs more. But it also has hundreds of times more resistance to motion than the feather, its inertial mass. Its attraction to the Earth is hundreds of times stronger than that of the feather, but then so is its inclination not to move. The result is that it accelerates downward at the same rate as the feather, although it seems that it should fall much faster. The fact that inertial mass and gravitational mass are equal was known 300 years ago, but physicists considered it a coincidence. No significance was attached to it until Einstein published his general theory of relativity. The coincidence of the equivalence of gravitational mass and inertial mass was the clue, C-L-E-W, to use Einstein's word, that led him to the principle of equivalence, which refers via the equivalence of gravitational mass and inertial mass to the equivalence of gravity and acceleration themselves. These are the things that he illustrated with his famous elevator examples. The special theory of relativity deals with unaccelerated, uniform motion. If acceleration is neglected, the special theory of relativity applies. However, since gravity and acceleration are equivalent, this is the same as saying that the special theory of relativity is applicable whenever gravity is neglected. If the effects of gravity are to be considered, then we must use the general theory of relativity. In the physical world, the effects of gravity can be neglected in 1. Remote regions of space, which are far from any centers of gravity, matter, and 2. In very small regions of space. Why gravity can be ignored in very small regions of space leads to the most psychedelic aspect of all Einstein's theories. Gravity can be ignored in very small regions of space because, if the region is small enough, the mountainous terrain of space-time is not noticeable. The nature of the space-time continuum is like that of a hilly countryside. The hills are caused by pieces of matter, objects. The larger the piece of matter, the more it curves the space-time continuum. In remote regions of space, far from any matter of significant size, the space-time continuum resembles a flat plane. A piece of matter the size of the Earth causes quite a bump in the space-time continuum, and a piece of matter the size of a star causes a relative mountain. As an object travels through the space-time continuum, it takes the easiest path between two points. The easiest path between two points in the space-time continuum is called a geodesic. A geodesic is not always a straight line, owing to the nature of the terrain in which the object finds itself. Suppose that we are in a balloon looking down on a mountain that has a bright beacon on the top of it. The mountain rises gradually out of the plane and becomes more and more steep as its elevation increases, until close to the top it rises almost straight up. There are many villages surrounding the mountain, and there are footpaths connecting all of the villages with each other. As the paths approach the mountain, all of them begin to curve in one way or another to avoid going unnecessarily far up the mountain. Suppose that it is nighttime and that looking down we can see neither the mountain nor the footpaths. All that we can see is the beacon and the torches of the travelers below. As we watch, we notice that the torches deflect from a straight path when they approach the vicinity of the beacon. Some of them curve gently around the beacon in a graceful arc some distance away from it. Others approach the beacon more directly, but the closer they get to it, the more sharply they turn away from it. From this, we probably would deduce that some force emanating from the beacon was repelling all attempts to approach it. For example, we might speculate that the beacon is extremely hot and painful to approach. With the coming of daylight, however, we can see that the beacon is situated on the top of a large mountain, and that it has nothing whatever to do with the movement of the torchbearers. They simply followed the easiest paths available to them over the terrain between their points of origin and destination. This masterful analogy was created by Bertrand Russell. In this case, the mountain is the sun, the travelers are the planets, asteroids, comets, and debris from the space program. The footpaths are their orbits, and the coming of daylight is the coming of Einstein's general theory of relativity. The point is that the objects in the solar system move as they do, not because of some mysterious force, gravity, exerted upon them at a distance by the sun, but because of the nature of the neighborhood through which they are traveling. Arthur Eddington illustrated this same situation in another way. Suppose, he suggested, that we are in a boat looking down into clear water. We can see the sand on the bottom and the fishes swimming beneath us. As we watch, we notice that the fish seem to be repelled from a certain point. As they approach it, they swim either to the right or to the left of it, but never over it. From this, we probably would deduce that there is a repellent force at that point which keeps the fish away. However, if we should go into the water to get a closer look, we would see that an enormous sunfish has buried himself in the sand at that point, creating a sizable mound. As fish swimming along the bottom approach the mound, they follow the easiest path available to them, which is around it rather than over it. There is no force causing the fish to avoid that particular spot. If all had been known from the first, that spot was merely the top of a large mound, which the fish found easier to swim around than to swim over. The movement of the fish was determined not by a force emanating from a mysterious spot, but by the nature of the neighborhood through which they were passing. Eddington's sunfish was called Albert, really. If we could see the geography, the geometry, of the space-time continuum, we would see that similarly it, and not forces between objects, is the reason that planets move in the ways that they do. It is not possible for us to actually see the geometry of the space-time continuum because it is four-dimensional, and our sensory experience is limited to three dimensions. For that reason, it is not even possible to picture it. For example, suppose that there existed a world of two-dimensional people. Such a world would look like a picture on a television or a movie screen. The people and the objects in a two-dimensional world would have height and width, but not depth. If these two-dimensional figures had a life and an intelligence of their own, their world would appear quite different to them than our world appears to us, for they could not experience the third dimension. A straight line drawn between two of these people would appear to them as a wall. They would be able to walk around either end of it, but they would not be able to step over it because their physical existence is limited to two dimensions. They cannot step off the screen into the third dimension. They would know what a circle is, but there is no way that they could know what a sphere is. In fact, a sphere would appear to them as a circle. If they like to explore, they soon would discover that their world is flat and infinite. If two of them went off in opposite directions, they would never meet. They also could create a simple geometry. Sooner or later, they would generalize their experiences into abstractions to help them do and build the things that they want to do and build in their physical world. For example, they would discover that whenever three straight metal bars form a triangle, the angles of the triangle always total 180 degrees. Sooner or later, the more perceptive among them would substitute mental idealizations, straight lines, for the metal bars. That would allow them to arrive at the abstract conclusion that a triangle, which by definition is formed by three straight lines, always contains 180 degrees. To learn more about triangles, they no longer would need actually to construct them. The geometry that such a two-dimensional people would create is the same geometry that we studied in school. It is called Euclidean geometry, in honor of the Greek Euclid, whose thoughts on the subject were so thorough that no one expanded on them for nearly 2,000 years. The content of most high school geometry books is about 2 millennia old. Now, let us suppose that someone, unbeknownst to them, transported these two-dimensional people from their flat world onto the surface of an enormously large sphere. This means that instead of being perfectly flat, their physical world now would be somewhat curved. At first, no one would notice the difference. However, if their technology improved enough to allow them to begin to travel and to communicate over great distances, these people eventually would make a remarkable discovery. They would discover that their geometry could not be verified in their physical world. For example, they would discover that if they surveyed a large enough triangle and measured the angles that form it, it would have more than 180 degrees. This is a simple phenomenon for us to picture. Imagine a triangle drawn on a globe. The apex, top of the triangle, is at the North Pole. The two lines intersecting there form a right angle. The equator is the base of the triangle. Look what happens. Both sides of the triangle, upon intersecting the equator, also form right angles. According to Euclidean geometry, a triangle contains only 2 right angles, 180 degrees. Yet this triangle contains 3 right angles, 270 degrees. Remember that in our example, the two-dimensional people actually have surveyed a triangle on what they presumed was their flat world, measured the angles, and come up with 270 degrees. What a confusion! When the dust settles, they would realize that there are only 2 possible explanations. The first possible explanation is that the straight lines used to construct the triangle, like light beams, were not actually straight, although they seemed to be straight. This could account for the excessive number of degrees in the triangle. However, if this is the explanation that they choose to adopt, then they must create a force responsible for somehow distorting the straight lines, like gravity. The second possible explanation is that their abstract geometry does not apply to their real world. This is another way of saying that, impossible as it sounds, their universe is not Euclidean. The idea that their physical reality is not Euclidean probably would sound so fantastic to them, especially if they had had no reason to question the reality of Euclidean geometry for 2,000 years, that they probably would choose to look for forces responsible for distorting their straight lines. The problem is that, having chosen this course, they would be obligated to create a responsible force every time that their physical world failed to validate Euclidean geometry. Eventually, the structure of these necessary forces would become so complex that it would be much simpler to forget them altogether and admit that their physical world does not follow the logically irrefutable rules of Euclidean geometry. Our situation is parallel to that of the two-dimensional people who cannot perceive, but who can deduce that they are living in a three-dimensional world. We are a three-dimensional people who cannot perceive, but who can deduce that we are living in a four-dimensional universe. For 2,000 years, we have assumed that the entire physical universe, like the geometry that the ancient Greeks created from their experience with this part of it, was Euclidean. That the geometry of Euclid is universally valid means that it can be verified anywhere in the physical world. That assumption was wrong. Einstein was the first person to see that the universe is not bound by the rules of Euclidean geometry, even though our minds tenaciously cling to the idea that it is. Although we cannot perceive the four-dimensional space-time continuum directly, we can deduce from what we already know of the special theory of relativity that our universe is not Euclidean. Here is another of Einstein's thought experiments. Imagine 2 concentric circles, one with a small radius and one with a very large radius. Both of them revolve around a common center. Imagine also that we, the observers, are watching these revolving circles from an inertial coordinate system. Being in an inertial coordinate system simply means that our frame of reference is at rest relative to everything, including the revolving circles. Drawn over the revolving circles are 2 identical concentric circles which are in our coordinate system. They are not revolving. They are the same size as the revolving circles and have the same common center, but they remain motionless. While we and our non-revolving circles are motionless, we are in communication with an observer who is on the revolving circles. He is actually going around with them. According to Euclidean geometry, the ratio of the radius to the circumference of all circles is the same. If we measure the radius and the circumference of the small circle, for example, the ratio of these two measurements will be the same as the ratio of the radius to the circumference of the large circle. The object of this thought experiment is to determine whether this is true or not for both the observers on the stationary circles, us, and the observer on the revolving circles. If the geometry of Euclid is valid throughout the physical universe, as it should be, we should discover that the ratio between the radius and the circumference of all the circles involved is identical. Both we and the observer on the revolving circles will use the same ruler to do our measuring. The same ruler means that either we actually hand him the same ruler that we have used, or that we use rulers that have the same length when at rest in the same coordinate system. We go first. Using our ruler, we measure the radius of our small circle, and then we measure the circumference of our small circle. Then we note the ratio between them. The next step is to measure the radius of our large circle, and then the circumference of our large circle. Then we note the ratio between them. Yes, it is the same ratio that we found between the radius and the circumference of our small circle. We have proved that Euclidean geometry is valid in our coordinate system, which is an inertial coordinate system. Now we hand the ruler to the observer on the revolving circles as he passes by us. Using this ruler, he first measures the radius of his small circle and finds that it is the same as ours, since our circles are drawn directly over his circles. Next, he measures the circumference of his small circle. Remember that motion causes rulers to contract in the direction that they are moving. However, since the radius of the small circle is so short, the velocity of the ruler when it is placed on the circumference of the small circle is not fast enough to make the effect of relativistic contraction noticeable. Therefore, the observer on the revolving circles measures the circumference of his small circle and finds it to be the same as the circumference of our small circle. Naturally, the ratio between them is also the same. So far, so good. The ratios between the radius and the circumference of three circles have been determined: our small circle, our large circle, and his small circle. And they all are identical. This is exactly what should happen according to high school geometry books across the country. Only one more circle to go. The observer on the revolving circles measures the radius of his large circle and finds it to be the same length as the radius of our large circle. Now he comes to the last measurement, the circumference of his large circle. However, as soon as he puts his ruler into position to make a measurement on the circumference of the large revolving circle, his ruler contracts. Because the radius of his large circle is much larger than the radius of his small circle, the velocity of the circumference of the large revolving circle is considerably faster than the velocity of the circumference of the small revolving circle. Since the ruler must be aligned in the direction that the circumference is moving, it becomes shorter. When the revolving observer uses this ruler to measure the circumference of the large revolving circle, he finds that it is larger than the circumference of our large circle. This is because his ruler is shorter. Contraction also affected his ruler when he measured the radius of his large circle, but since it then was placed perpendicular to the direction of motion, it became skinnier, not shorter. This means that the ratio of the radius to the circumference of the small revolving circle is not the same as the ratio of the radius to the circumference of the large revolving circle. According to Euclidean geometry, this is not possible, but there it is. If we want to be old-fashioned about it, before Einstein, we can say that this situation is nothing unusual. If we want to be old-fashioned about it, before Einstein, we can say that this situation is nothing unusual. By definition, the laws of mechanics and the geometry of Euclid are valid only in inertial systems. That is what makes them inertial systems. We simply don't consider coordinate systems which are not inertial. This was really the position of physicists before Albert Einstein. This is exactly what seemed wrong to Einstein. His idea was to create a physics valid for all coordinate systems, since the universe abounds with the non-inertial as well as the inertial kind. If we are to create such a universally valid physics, a general physics, then we must treat both the observers in the stationary, inertial system and the observer in the revolving circles, a non-inertial system, with equal seriousness. The person on the revolving circles has as much right to relate the physical world to his frame of reference as we have to relate it to ours. True, the laws of mechanics as well as the geometry of Euclid are not valid in his frame of reference, but every deviation from them can be explained in terms of a gravitational field which affects his frame of reference. This is what Einstein's theory allows us to do. It allows us to express the laws of physics in such a way that they are independent of specific space-time coordinates. Space and time coordinates, measurements, vary from one frame of reference to the other, depending upon the state of motion of the frame of reference. The general theory of relativity allows us to universalize the laws of physics and to apply them to all frames of reference. Wait a minute, we say. How can anyone measure distance or navigate in a coordinate system like the one on the revolving circles? The length of a ruler varies from place to place in such a system. The farther we go from the center, the faster the velocity of the ruler, and the more it contracts. This doesn't happen in an inertial coordinate system, which in effect is a system that is at rest. Because there is no change of velocity throughout an inertial coordinate system, rulers do not change length. This allows us to organize inertial systems like a city, block by block. Since rulers do not change length in inertial systems, all the blocks that are laid out with the same ruler will be the same length. No matter where we travel, we know that 10 blocks is twice the distance of 5 blocks. In a non-inertial system, the velocity of the system varies from place to place. This means that the length of a ruler varies from place to place. If we use the same ruler to lay out all the city blocks in a non-inertial coordinate system, some of them would be larger than others depending upon where they were located. What is wrong with that? Asks Jim DeWitt, as long as we still can determine our position in the coordinate system. Imagine a sheet of India rubber on which we have drawn a grid so that it looks like a piece of graph paper. This is a coordinate system. Assuming that we are at the lower left corner, we can start anywhere. Let us say that a party Saturday night is being held at a given intersection on the graph. To get there, we have to go 2 squares to the right and 2 squares up. Now suppose that we stretch the sheet of rubber so that the top is longer than the bottom. The same directions, 2 squares right and 2 squares up, still bring us to the party. The only difference is that unless we are familiar with this part of the coordinate system, we cannot calculate the distance that we have to travel as easily as we could if all the squares were the same size. According to the general theory of relativity, gravity, which is the equivalent of acceleration, is what distorts the space-time continuum in a manner analogous to our stretching the sheet of rubber. Where the effects of gravity can be neglected, the space-time continuum is like the sheet of rubber before we stretched it. All of the lines are straight lines, and all of the clocks are synchronized. In other words, the undistorted sheet of rubber is analogous to the space-time continuum of an inertial coordinate system, and the special theory of relativity applies. However, in the universe at large, gravity cannot be neglected. Wherever there is a piece of matter, it warps the space-time continuum. The larger the piece of matter, the more pronounced the warp. In the example of the revolving circles, the variation of velocity in different parts of the coordinate system caused the ruler to change size. With that in mind, remember that acceleration, change in velocity, is the equivalent of gravity. Therefore, changes in the strength of a gravitational field will produce the same contractions of the ruler as changes in velocity. Acceleration and gravity are two ways of saying the same thing. That means that if a ruler is subjected to gravitational fields of different strength, it changes length. Of course, it is impossible to travel through our solar system, much less our galaxy, without encountering gravitational fields of varying intensity, which would cause any maps that we somehow could produce to look distorted like the stretched piece of India rubber. The terrain of the space-time continuum in which our Earth moves is like a hilly countryside with a mountain, the sun, dominating the geography. According to Newton, the Earth wants to continue forever in a straight line, but forever is deflected from its inclination by the gravitational force of the sun. A balance of the two keeps the Earth in orbit around the sun. According to Einstein, the Earth's orbit is simply the easiest path for the Earth to take as it moves through the space-time continuum, warped as it is in this neighborhood by the sun. Imagine how complex is the geography of the space-time continuum, which is our universe, with its solar systems, star systems, galaxies, and galaxy clusters, each of them causing major and minor bumps, curves, hills, valleys, and mountains in the four-dimensional space-time continuum. Would it be possible to navigate under such circumstances? Yes. Although it is a crude example, sailors navigate under somewhat analogous circumstances. We cover the Earth with squares which are formed by lines of latitude and longitude. The size of these squares varies depending upon where they are located. The closer they are to the equator, the larger they are. If this is unclear, look at a globe. Nonetheless, we can still locate physical points on the surface of the Earth by designating the intersection of a line of latitude and a line of longitude. Knowing the number of squares between us and where we want to sail does not give us the distance to our destination because the squares may vary in size. However, if we know the nature of our terrain, a globe, we can calculate distances on it using spherical trigonometry. Similarly, once we know the properties of an area of the space-time continuum by exploring it, we can determine not only the position of, but also the distance interval between two events in the space-time continuum. The mathematical structure of the general theory of relativity, which Einstein created over a period of 10 years, permits us to do just that. The equations of the general theory of relativity are structural formulas. They describe the structure of changing gravitational fields. Newton's formula describes a situation between two objects at a given time. Einstein's formulas relate a situation here and now to a situation in the immediate vicinity a little later. By feeding the results of actual observations into these equations, they give us a picture of the space-time continuum in the neighborhood of our observations. In other words, they reveal the geometry of space-time in that area. Once we know that, our situation is roughly analogous to that of a sailor who knows that the Earth is round and also knows spherical trigonometry. We have said up to now that matter distorts or causes a curvature of the space-time continuum in its vicinity. According to Einstein's ultimate vision, which he never proved, demonstrated mathematically, a piece of matter is a curvature of the space-time continuum. In other words, according to Einstein's ultimate vision, there are no such things as gravitational fields and masses. They are only mental creations. No such things exist in the real world. There is no such thing as gravity. Gravity is the equivalent of acceleration, which is motion. There is no such thing as matter. Matter is a curvature of the space-time continuum. There is not even such a thing as energy. Energy equals mass, and mass is space-time curvature. What we considered to be a planet with its own gravitational field moving around the Sun in an orbit created by the gravitational attraction, force, of the Sun, is actually a pronounced curvature of the space-time continuum finding its easiest path through the space-time continuum in the vicinity of a very pronounced curvature of the space-time continuum. There is nothing but space-time and motion, and they, in effect, are the same thing. Here is an exquisite presentation, in completely Western terms, of the most fundamental aspect of Taoist and Buddhist philosophies. Physics is the study of physical reality. If a theory does not relate to the physical world, it may be pure mathematics, poetry, or blank verse, but it is not physics. The question is, does Einstein's fantastic theory really work? The answer is a slightly tentative, but generally accepted, yes. Most physicists agree that the general theory of relativity is a valid way of viewing large-scale phenomena, and at the same time, most physicists still are eager to see more evidence to confirm or challenge this position. Since the general theory of relativity deals with vast expanses of the universe, its proof, of usefulness, not of truth, the watch is still unopenable, cannot come from observations of phenomena limited to the Earth. For this reason, its verifications come from astronomy. Thus far, the general theory of relativity has been verified in four ways. The first three ways are straightforward and convincing. The last way, if early observations are correct, may be more fantastic than the theory itself. The first verification of the general theory of relativity came as an unexpected benefit to astronomers. Newton's law of gravity purported to describe the orbits of the planets around the Sun, and it did, all of them except Mercury. Mercury orbits the Sun in such a way that some parts of its orbit bring it closer to the Sun than others. The part of Mercury's orbit closest to the Sun is called its perihelion. The first verification of Einstein's general theory of relativity turned out to be the long-sought explanation of the problem of Mercury's perihelion. The problem with Mercury's perihelion, in fact with Mercury's entire orbit, is that it moves. Instead of continuously retracing its path around the Sun relative to a coordinate system attached to the Sun, Mercury's orbit itself revolves around the Sun. The rate of revolution is extremely slow. It completes one revolution around the Sun every 3 million years. This still was enough to puzzle astronomers. Prior to Einstein, this precession in Mercury's orbit had been attributed to an undiscovered planet in our solar system. By the time Einstein published his general theory of relativity, the search for this mysterious planet was well underway. Einstein created his general theory of relativity without special attention to the perihelion of Mercury. However, when the general theory of relativity was applied to this problem, it showed that Mercury moves precisely as Mercury has to move through the space-time continuum in that vicinity of the Sun. The other planets do not move significantly in this way because they are farther away from the Sun's gravity. Score 1 for the general theory. The second verification of the general theory of relativity was the fulfillment of a prediction specifically made by Einstein. Einstein predicted that light beams are bent by gravitational fields. He also predicted exactly how much they are bent, and he suggested an experiment to test this prediction. Einstein suggested that astronomers measure the deflection of starlight by the gravitational field of the Sun. According to Einstein, the presence of the Sun between a group of visible stars and the Earth will cause an apparent change in the position of the stars because light coming from them will be bent by the gravitational field of the Sun. In order to perform this experiment, it is necessary to photograph a group of stars at night, noting their positions relative to each other and other stars on their periphery, and then to photograph the same group during the day when the Sun is between them and us. Of course, stars can only be photographed in the daytime during a total eclipse of the Sun by the Moon. Astronomers consulted their star charts and discovered that May 29th is the ideal day for such an undertaking. This is because the Sun, in its apparent journey across a varied stellar background, is in front of an exceptionally rich grouping of bright stars on that date. By incredible coincidence, a total eclipse of the Sun occurred on May 29, 1919, only 4 years after the general theory was published. Preparations were made to use this event to test Einstein's new theory. Light signals from a star are bent in the neighborhood of the Sun. Because we assume that starlight travels in a straight line, we assume that the star is in a position other than it actually is. Although light was supposed to travel in a straight line in a vacuum, a certain amount of bending already was theorized before Einstein's general theory of relativity. Newton's law of gravity was used to calculate this bending, even though it could not explain it. Einstein's theory predicted roughly twice the deflection that Newton's law predicted, and in addition, it supplied an explanation for it. Physicists and astronomers alike eagerly awaited the outcome of this confrontation between the new theory and the old. The 1919 eclipse was photographed by two different expeditions sent to two different parts of the world. These expeditions also took photographs of the same stellar background at times when the Sun was not in the area. The results of both expeditions vindicated Einstein's calculations, not Newton's. Since 1919, the same verdict has been reached again and again during other eclipses. All of them confirm Einstein's predictions. Score 2 for the general theory. The third verification of the general theory of relativity is called gravitational redshift. Remember that gravity, because it is the equivalent of acceleration, not only causes rulers to contract, but it also causes clocks to run more slowly. A clock is anything that repeats itself periodically. An atom is a type of clock. It vibrates at a certain frequency. When a substance like sodium is made to glow, the wavelength of the light that it emits can be measured accurately. This wavelength tells us exactly the frequency of the vibrations of the atoms that comprise the substance. If the frequency should vary, the wavelength also will vary. If we want to compare the rhythm of a clock here on the Earth with the rhythm of a clock that is influenced by an intense gravitational field like that of the Sun, we do not need to send a clock to the surface of the Sun. The clocks already are in place. Einstein predicted that any periodic process that takes place in an atom on the Sun, where the gravity is very intense, must take place at a slightly slower rate than it does here on the Earth. To test this prediction, all we need do is compare the wavelength of the radiation of a given element as it is found in sunlight and as it is found here on Earth in the laboratory. This has been done many times. In each case, the wavelength measured from the sunlight was found to be longer than its laboratory counterpart. A longer wavelength means a lower, slower frequency. Sodium atoms, for example, vibrate more slowly under the influence of the sun's strong gravitational field than they do on the Earth. So do all the atoms. This phenomenon is called gravitational redshift because the wavelengths involved appear to be shifted slightly toward the red end of the visible light spectrum, where the wavelengths are the longest. Score 3 for the general theory. Mercury's moving perihelion, starlight deflection, and gravitational redshift are all observable phenomena. Now we come to an area where theory is still predominant and observation is minimal. Nonetheless, it is an area that is by far the most exciting and perhaps the most stimulating in the entire history of science. The fourth verification of the general theory of relativity appears to be the phenomenon of the black hole. In 1958, David Finkelstein published a paper in which he theorized, on the basis of Einstein's general theory of relativity, a phenomenon that he called a one-way membrane. Finkelstein showed that under certain conditions involving an extremely dense gravitational field, an invisible threshold can occur into which light and physical objects can enter, but from which they can never again escape. Footnote. This phenomenon was theorized by Pierre-Simon Laplace in 1795 using Newtonian physics. Finkelstein was the first physicist to formulate it from the modern point of view, i.e. relativity theory. This modern formulation triggered the current theories on the black hole. End of footnote. The following year, a young graduate student at the University of London heard Finkelstein, who was speaking there as a guest lecturer, explain his one-way membrane. The idea caught his attention and then his imagination. The young student was Roger Penrose. Expanding on Finkelstein's discovery, he developed it into the modern theory of the black hole. Footnote. The very first modern paper on black holes was done by J.R. Oppenheimer and S. Snyder in 1939. The current theories of the black hole, i.e. black hole singularities which are beyond space-time, were developed independently by R. Penrose and S. W. Hawking. End of footnote. A black hole is an area of space which appears absolutely black because the gravitation there is so intense that not even light can escape into the surrounding areas. Footnote. To a first approximation, physicists currently theorize that black holes actually shine due to photons and other particles quantum tunneling out of the one-way membranes. End of footnote. Gravitation is negligible on the laboratory level, but quite important when bodies of large mass are concerned. Therefore, the exploration of black holes naturally became a joint venture of physicists and astronomers. Astronomers speculated that a black hole may be one of several possible products of stellar evolution. Stars do not burn indefinitely. They evolve through a life cycle which begins with hydrogen gas and sometimes ends with a very dense, burned-out, rotating mass. The exact end product of this process depends upon the size of the star undergoing it. According to one theory, stars which are about 3 times the size of our sun or larger end up as black holes. The remains of such stars are unimaginably dense. They may be only a few miles in diameter and yet contain the entire mass of a star 3 times larger than the sun. Such a dense mass produces a gravitational field strong enough to pull everything in its vicinity into it, while at the same time allowing nothing, not even light, to escape from it. Surrounding this remainder of a star is an event horizon. An event horizon is created by the enormous gravitational field of the burned-out star. It functions precisely like Finkelstein's one-way membrane. Anything within the gravitational field of this mass quickly is pulled toward it, and once past the event horizon, never can return. It is the event horizon which constitutes the essential feature of the black hole. What happens to an object that passes through an event horizon is even more fantastic than the wildest, currently, science fiction. If the black hole is not rotating, the object will be pulled directly to the center of the black hole to a point called the singularity. There it literally will be squeezed out of existence, or as physicists say, to zero volume. At the black hole singularity, all of the laws of physics break down completely, and even space and time disappear. It is speculated that everything which is sucked into a black hole is spilled out again on the other side being another universe. If the black hole is rotating, an object that is sucked into the event horizon could miss the black hole singularity, which is shaped like a ring in a rotating black hole, and emerge into another time and another place in this universe, through wormholes, or into another universe, through Einstein-Rosen bridges. In this way, rotating black holes may be the ultimate time machines. Although black holes are almost invisible, we can search for observable phenomena that may be characteristic of them. The first of these is a large amount of electromagnetic radiation. A black hole continuously attracts hydrogen atoms, cosmic particles, and everything else to it. As these particles and objects are drawn to the black hole, they steadily accelerate through its gravitational field until they approach the velocity of light itself. This causes tremendous amounts of electromagnetic radiation. Any accelerating charged particle creates electromagnetic radiation. The second observable characteristic of an invisible black hole is its effect on a nearby visible star. If a visible star can be found which moves as though it were revolving around an invisible star, i.e., as though it were half of a binary star system, we might speculate that it actually is revolving around an invisible star and that its invisible partner is a black hole. The search for black holes consequently became the search for these two phenomena. In 1970, the satellite Uhuru located both of them in one area. It pinpointed a high-energy X-ray source in the constellation Cygnus, which emits a million times more energy than the Sun. This high-energy source of electromagnetic radiation, which came to be known as Cygnus X-1, is very close to a visible blue-hot supergiant star. Scientists now believe that this blue supergiant forms a binary system with the black hole, Cygnus X-1. As the visible star and the invisible black hole orbit each other, the blue supergiant literally is being sucked into the black hole. As material is torn away from its surface, it plunges into the black hole at tremendous speed, emitting X-rays. Incredible as Cygnus X-1 is, more than 100 similar objects have been detected within our own Milky Way galaxy since its discovery. Although black holes stretch our imagination to the limit, the evidence is mounting that they actually do exist. For example, if black holes are as we have speculated them to be, whatever disappears into them reappears somewhere. Is it possible, therefore, that there are black holes in other universes which are sucking matter from those universes into our universe? This is a seriously considered possibility. There are objects in our universe that appear to be the reverse of black holes. They are called white holes, of course. These objects are quasi-stellar radio sources, or quasars for short. Quasars are extraordinarily intense energy sources. Most of them are only several times the diameter of our solar system, yet they emit more energy than an entire galaxy of over 150 billion stars. Some astronomers believe that quasars are the most distant objects ever detected, yet their incredible brightness allows us to see them clearly. The relationship between black holes and quasars is purely speculation, but the speculation is mind-boggling. For example, some physicists speculate that black holes swallow up matter from one universe and pump it either into another universe or into another part and time of the same universe. The output side of a black hole, according to this hypothesis, is a quasar. If this speculation is correct, then our universe is being sucked into its many black holes, only to reappear in other universes, while other universes are being pumped into our own universe, which is being sucked through black holes and into other universes again. The process goes on and on, feeding on itself, another beginningless, endless, endless, beginningless dance. One of the most profound byproducts of the general theory of relativity is the discovery that gravitational force, which we had so long taken to be a real and independently existing thing, is actually our mental creation. There is no such thing in the real world. The planets do not orbit the sun because the sun exerts an invisible gravitational force on them. They follow the paths that they do because those paths are the easiest ways for them to traverse the terrain of the space-time continuum in which they find themselves. The same is true for nonsense. It is a mental creation. There is no such thing in the real world. From one frame of reference, black holes and event horizons make sense. From another frame of reference, absolute non-motion makes sense. Neither is nonsense except as seen from another point of view. We call something nonsense if it does not agree with the rational edifices that we carefully have constructed. However, there is nothing intrinsically valuable about these edifices. In fact, they themselves often are replaced by more useful ones. When that happens, what was nonsensical from an old frame of reference can make sense from a new frame of reference, and the other way around. Like measurements of space and time, the concept of nonsense, itself a type of measurement, is relative, and we always can be sure when we use it that from some frame of reference it applies to us.